and welcome to an episode of Everything is Cannabis, Emily's podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at SteveDunk5 or at EverythingCanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Adiba Jergadar all about her brand new book, Hani and Ishu's Guide to Fake Dating, which is described as "To All the Boys I've Loved Before meets LGBTQ+ romance in this funny, heartwarming rom-com about first love and identity." Like her first published book, The Henna Wars, Hani and Ishu's Guide to Fake Dating is a ridiculously charming and wonderfully complex story about falling in love, family, and gleefully dunking on bigotry, all while giving us a lesson in dignity and empathy. It's a thoughtful examination of not only the diversity within the Muslim community itself, but also how they are oftentimes wrongly perceived by those around them. I really, really love this fake dating to lovers story and feel absolutely head over heels for Humaira and Ishita. You will too. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out. So if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but definitely double back once you've had a chance to read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, if we ever do that again, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices. And this should be done all year long. Adiba Jergadar was born in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and has been living in Dublin, Ireland since the age of 10. That means almost nothing. We don't know how old she is now, but I'm not going to ask her. She has a BA in English and History from the University of College Dublin and an MA in Postcolonial Studies from the University of Kent. Pretty impressive for me anyways, because I'm dumb. A year ago, around this time, she released The Henna Wars, which was named a Best Book of the Year by Kirkus and was a semi-finalist for Best Young Adult Fiction in the Goodreads Choice Awards. I don't know how much weight that carries with her, but we'll ask her maybe. I highly encourage you to read it if you haven't. It's incredible. When she's not writing, she can be found ranting about the ills of colonialism, playing video games, and expanding her overflowing lipstick collection. She's here today to talk about her new novel, Hani and Ishu's Guide to Fake Dating, which is described as "To All the Boys I've Loved Before meets LGBT romance in this funny, heartwarming rom-com about first love and identity." Like The Henna Wars, it's a ridiculously charming and wonderfully complex story about falling in love, family, and gleefully dunking on bigotry, all while giving us a lesson in dignity and empathy. As I said many times, I'm not prone to bullshit. I really, really love this book, and I fell head over heels for Humaira and Ishita, and I know everyone will. Please welcome Adiba Jergadar to the show. Hi, Adiba.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me today.
Sure. Wishing you all the blessings for this holy month. How is your Ramadan going?
It's going okay. A little bit, you know, tiring, but That's, I guess, par for the course.
Sure. Is that just a calories thing?
I think it's also, you know, it's our second Ramadan in lockdown.
Right.
And Ramadan is so much about like community and, you know, like usually during Ramadan, we'll go to like iftar parties with people, we'll share food, we'll donate food to the mosque so that, you know, those we can share with our community. Yep. And all of that is kind of difficult when there's a pandemic going on.
Right. So it's, yeah, all the wonderful sort of positive things about Ramadan are almost voided at this point. Not voided, but difficult anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that sucks. Speaking of the pandemic, I just want to say, you know, I hope you and your family and friends are safe and healthy during these times. And I'm not sure what's going on in Ireland at the moment with numbers and stuff, but either way, as we're in this weird time now, right? There's a transition because, you know, there's vaccinating going on and other things and people are handling it differently. So it's actually kind of a more dangerous time in a way, isn't it? Because people are
eating. Yeah.
So anyways, I hope you and your family and friends are all safe and have been safe and avoided any nastiness anyways.
Thank you. I hope the same for you and your family and friends.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm in Canada, so our numbers haven't been too bad. And, you know, honestly, the pandemic hasn't cramped my style that much. I stay in and read anyway. So sadly, right? You know, it doesn't, my social life didn't take a hit.
I mean, that's a pretty nice life, you know, staying in and reading.
I don't have kids. I you know, I'm home a lot. So it's really easy to do. It's wonderful. Trust me. Yeah. Before we get too far ahead, too, I did want to give a quick shout out, actually, to Nabiha Deir Ali. I hope I said that right. Who did the covers for both of your books, the art. And they're amazing. So I encourage people to seek out Nabi's art online. It's Nabiha Deir Ali. What is the website called? At myportfolio.com. Wonderful artist, and did the covers for both the Henna Wars and Hani Issues Guide to Fake Dating. I didn't want to forget that because it's beautiful. You must have been super happy with the. Obviously, you've twice now. So,
yeah. Yeah, no, his work is just amazing. And actually, he even illustrated the cover for the UK edition of Hani and Issues Guide to Fake Dating. Okay. So actually, he's done three of my covers so far, technically.
Right. The UK, is that the one where they're back to back more?
Yeah, that's the one.
Right, beautiful. Yeah, really nice. Just, and I don't know who did the layouts. He didn't do the layouts, did he? Just the art.
Yeah, just the art. Yeah. I think for the US, the designer is, I think her name is Julie Tyler. I could be wrong. Like, all the names are up on my website.
Okay.
If you're interested. I don't know who did the design for the UK edition though.
Okay. They're beautiful. I really, really, they're so, like, it's just, you know what I mean? There's some covers that are a mess, right? You read a lot of books every year. You see a lot of books yourself. There's some covers that you can't, I'm not naming names. I'm just saying there's some you're like, hey, what's going on there? These are beautiful. I love them. Especially, you know, in particular, the Henna Wars one. I just fell in love with that cover. I remember the first time I saw it. I was like, oh my gosh. One of the few times when you want to judge a book by its cover, right? when it's that beautiful. So, and again, and I don't want to dwell on the pandemic too much, but you've written a book, you know, with a pandemic and without now. How was that for you, experience wise? Did it change anything at all? I mean, you're shut in anyways when you're writing, you're in the zone, right? So, but
yeah.
Did it change anything for you at all, or?
Actually, I wrote Hani and Issues Guide to Fake Dating before the pandemic.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I wrote it, I think, like September 2019. Usually, you know, books take a while to get off the ground. So,
sure.
There
must have been edits and rewrites, though.
There were edits. I think during the time when the Henna Wars was actually releasing, I was on deadline for revising Hani and Issue.
As always. Don't you love how they always time it that way, don't they?
Yeah, they really do. I wish they didn't, but they do.
I know.
And it was, honestly, like, I feel like revising that book during the pandemic and while releasing a book was actually good for me because it kind of helped me to not, like, get so caught up in what the pandemic was and like spiraling into like anxiety and things.
Sure,
after I turned in all my revisions, I feel like then I kind of had a moment where I was like, oh my God, like what is going on with the world, you know? And before that, I didn't really even have time to like think about it too much.
Right. Well, it's true. I mean, the story is very affirming for sure. Right. So that helps, I guess, if you're looking to shut out certain aspects of the outside world. But it doesn't shut out everything. Right. There's some important themes and issues in this book for sure. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to totally escape, you know, the real world when you're writing, touching on certain subjects, which we'll talk about. But that's good. Yeah. It's you know, you talked to a lot of authors and it's everyone's got sort of a different way of handling it. But that's sort of been the common sentiment is that, like, yeah, I'm at my desk either way, pandemic or not, so or whatever their setup is, right? So what's changed is the marketing, obviously, right? Like I don't know what, if you have any in-person events planned or what state you know, Ireland's in and stuff like that, but normally you'd be packing a bag right now, right? Or getting ready to anyways, and getting ready to do some in-person events, but do you have anything like that planned, or is it just all virtual still, all digital?
I think right now everything is still virtual, though I think in Ireland we're now slowly reopening a little bit. So you know, maybe I can go sign some books or something at some point.
Yeah.
Somebody actually asked me, it was funny, somebody asked me after the Henna Wars came out, they were like, I think it was like about 6 or 7 months after it had been out. And they asked, what did it feel like to see your book in a bookshop? And I was like,
I don't know.
Has not happened yet. And it still hasn't happened. So hopefully sometime soon that can happen.
Oh, that'll be a beautiful moment. I hope you take a picture of that. Cause that's sort of one of the boxes you check, right? Like obviously it starts with getting a book, you know, somebody picking it up, you know, buying it. And then you get to the unboxing and then, yeah. And seeing it out in the wild, that's a big, big first moment, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, people have sent me pictures, which is really nice, but seeing it myself is like, I assume a different experience.
If it's not, then there's something wrong with you. I'm just saying that. It better be a different experience. It'll be a wonderful, beautiful experience. So I hope, that'll be so great for you. I'm very, very happy for you. God, that's so weird to think about. Yeah. Cause, you know, you're robbed of just, and it's such a simple act, isn't it? Right. Like, I mean, I don't know where the closest bookstore is to you, but you know, presumably within walking distance, maybe, but such a simple act and you can't even do that. It's kind of a weird, I don't know. Anyways, on to bigger and better things, hopefully. Right.
Yeah.
I was just sort of, I think I was reading an interview or something with you somewhere and you'd mentioned that the Henna Wars was actually the second book that you queried. What was the first one? And I'm just wondering, if the first one was rejected, obviously that didn't deter you from, you know, carrying on, obviously. So I'm just wondering how that process was for you. Cause you know, rejection is hard, obviously nobody likes it, but that didn't stop you at all.
Yeah. So my first one that I queried was actually completely different from the Henna Wars. It was adult literary fiction.
Okay.
But I think it had like a lot of the like similar themes. It was the first time that I actually wrote about like Bangladeshi people and queer Bangladeshi people. And I think it was very much like a stepping stone into me being able to write the Henna Wars. And you know, like I've been writing since I was very, very young. I've been writing novels since I was like 12 or 13. So for me, like, and even like submitting short stories and things to like journals and magazines. So for me, I feel like even when I was querying, like rejection was just something that didn't really hit me that hard. I just kind of rolled with it.
Yeah.
I knew that, you know, if that first book I queried didn't get an agent, I was like, well, I have so many books that I want to work on. It's going to happen at some point.
Right.
So
it's a funny thing because it is such a, it is a, to say it's a normal part of the process is an understatement, right? I mean, like, you know, if somebody tells you they got zero rejection, there are examples in the history of publishing, of course, but very, very few. And it's such a big part of it. And, you know, it's always a nice thing to hear. It always makes me feel good when I talk to an author and they didn't, you know, they're just like, yeah, okay, let's keep going. Right. Like they didn't like this one. Fine. We'll just wait till they see what I got next. You know what I mean? So I always like hearing those stories because, you know, it'd be depressing to hear of somebody just, you know, after one rejection saying, you know what, I'll just go be a pilot or something instead. I don't know, whatever.
You know? And I mean, you wouldn't be talking to them, right? Because
true enough, these are the things I think about. And then especially when you get into sort of, you know, BIPOC writers who have never had the opportunity even, right? A lot of times I, this is my life. I spend my time thinking about all these, not only unwritten just stories, but just unpublished ideas, because it's not fair, right? Publishing isn't fair. And I think about all these stories we'll never get to see because of that. And that's keeps me up at night. But again, that's my mental problem, not yours or anybody else's. But it's around the same time, actually, I'd read A Misfit in Love by SKLE. And you know, sort of what I like, and I'm not comparing that book to yours at all, only in the sense,
oh my God, if you do, that would be such an honor and privilege, because SKLE is one of my favorite writers of all time.
She's incredible and Misfit in Love and is really great. And it's a wonderful sequel. And the only reason I compare it is because it's about the Muslim experience, right? And in a beautiful way. And one of the great things I like about that and your book and the Henna Wars and Miss Khan's book and all these great books that have come out, it's for a white Western audience, being polite here, you know, who watches the news too much, right? And doesn't understand that, or, you know, Muslims, you know, aren't like everybody else, aren't a monolith, right? They come in many, you know, shapes, sizes, colors, shades, whatever. And it's, it, when you encompass all these great stories, it's really great. It's really important. And I hope reaches these wider audiences and these Rust Belt people, we'll call them, you know, to understand that being a Muslim means so many different things, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite part about that aspect of the Muslim community? Because it's a wonderful, it is a beautiful community that like, it's such a great, you know, shared experience. And the more you learn about it, the more you appreciate it. For me anyways, and I'm an atheist. So it's like, I'm able to, I think, look at it from an outsider's point of view. And when you start to see all these little facets of it, all these beautiful things that make it unique, it's just like, wow, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. For me, I mean, there's so many things about, you know, being a Muslim that I really love, but mm-hmm. I think probably my favorite thing is the generosity that exists in Islam and just Muslim culture. Mm-hmm. Even like all our major holidays, you know, they're actually built around being generous and mm-hmm. Giving to people. For example, during Ramadan, you literally have, you know, an obligation to give a certain amount of money to those who are,
right.
You know, not as well off as you. Same for like each of our Eids, we are expected to like share things, not just with, you know, poorer people, but also a lot of the times with our community and with our family. My dad once actually said to me that if a Muslim person is rich, they cannot be Muslim. Mm. And, you know, the reason why he said this is because as a Muslim, you are expected to always look out for your family and for your community. That's like part of your responsibility, not just looking out for yourself. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, if you are a Muslim person and you are like a billionaire, you have to ask yourself, how can you be happy like that when your community is not a billionaire, you know?
The socialist. So that really appeals. I'm a socialist. So that's beautiful mm-hmm. to me, right? I love that. You know, that's the way I am. You know what I mean? I love, you know, I have no problem, you know, helping out people I will never meet. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? I have no problem with that. I love that sentiment too. And it just makes so much sense to me. I wish it made sense to more people, obviously.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. One of the things I liked about, and again, sort of SK's book is more in her book, I suppose, than yours, but a lot of this interfaith relationships and how even, you know, different Muslims not only deal with it as far as certain families accept it more than others. And what's that like in your experience growing up with interfaith relationships? Because, you know, you make a point in your book too, which I really liked, is that, you know, Ireland is becoming really progressive regards to Muslim community anyways. Is that your real life experience there or?
Yes, kind of. I think it's fluctuating. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like with the way that the world is, I feel like, you know, we have gotten quite progressive just in general in the Western world, but now suddenly we're kind of taking a swing to like the left wing side of politics. Mm-hmm. And I think when you have like, you know, these big superpowers like the US and the UK, and they kind of go towards more left-wing politics, it's going to have like a domino effect, and you know, it's going to affect a lot of other countries. So yeah, I think it's kind of fluctuating because you know, growing up, I did see, you know, how progressive Ireland was slowly becoming. And when I first moved here when I was 10 years old, I would almost never see like brown people around me or, mm-hmm. you know, Muslim people around me. But now, like, I will get on the tram to, or I would, I guess, like a couple years ago, to go to work, and there would be like a bunch of like hijabi people around me. Right. And I could literally see with my own eyes like that shift. But in terms of, you know, in terms of politics and attitudes, I do think with growing population of, you know, people of color and Muslims, places tend to actually get less accepting and less tolerant. So right. Yeah, that's been my experience.
Yeah, which fucking sucks, obviously. And you know, one of the things that's interesting to me is there's so much, you know, politicking going on even just within your own communities, right? Because of what we talked about earlier, how it's not a monolith, right? There's different, you know, different Muslims have different sets of beliefs, and there are, in your book too, you have Bengalis who aren't Muslim at all, right? So it's an interesting thing. So even within the community, there's this wonderful sort of like melting pot. Maybe it's not always wonderful. I guess it depends on your point of view, right? maybe for a queer Muslim, it's not always been great. I don't know. But that's the thing too, is where, you know, you're dealing with this Islamophobia on the outside of your community. And then even within the community, there's sort of different phobias as well, isn't there? Mm-hmm. What was that like for you? And then what was that like, translating that into a story, into a narrative, right? Because that's you're a storyteller primarily, but obviously you have a lot of your own personal views and feelings on it, and because you've experienced so much yourself, right?
I
don't want to get too personal. If I'm getting too personal, just tell me to shut up. it's fine. But in a general sense, if you can, maybe, like, you know, because obviously your real life experiences have affected your stories, right? That's very obvious, right? And it's beautiful, and it's a wonderful thing. And so I think it's maybe fair game to ask about it. But well, again, without getting too personal, I don't want to.
I think for a long time it was difficult for me to reconcile like different parts of my identity, just because, like you said, like not just, you know, being Muslim and being queer, but also like being queer and being Muslim, you know, the opposite of that. It can be really difficult to reconcile those parts of your identities, because whichever community you kind of go to, they have like certain ideas about you and they're not necessarily going to accept you. But then I think I'm a very privileged person, because I did get to meet so many people who are also like me. So, you know, right now, thanks to the internet, I guess, right now, you know, I do have a lot of friends who are queer and Muslim, or, you know, who are just, you know, from have different experiences in life that still I can kind of relate to. And I think kind of having these people and being able to like have conversations with them and learn about their experiences as well as mine, that's been really like affirming for me. And that's really helped me kind of reconcile all these different parts of my identity, and, you know, helped me be able to write these kinds of books.
That's a beautiful segue, by the way. Thank you. Because talking about just sort of like online and being connected, you know, to people around the world. We'll get to the book in a minute here. Trust me. we will talk about the book, I promise. But I couldn't help. I was just, again, just sort of, I was reading some of your blog pieces, and there was one that stood out to me. It was actually, you released it on my birthday, March 8th last year. it was a piece called Waiting for the Other Shoe to Drop. One of the things you said in it was, so much of this irrational fear comes from being a woman of color, and being a woman of color in this industry specifically. It feels like even when I'm here, I'm not here. Like there was so little value ascribed to me, I might as well not be here at all, end quote, which is heartbreaking to read, obviously. And, you know, the piece you wrote is a response to an incident that occurred in a chat group where you and your friend, you know, the only two women of color, were singled out and verbally berated for simply expressing a point of view, essentially, right? That was just over a year ago now. And, you know, this past year, if nothing, has brought a lot of these things to the forefront. Not necessarily always in a good way, and not always necessarily in a productive way either. I'm just wondering, it's been a year since you released that, and over a year now. Is there anything that you've seen or experienced that makes you feel like the needle has moved at all, no matter how small, in the right direction?
I wish I could say yes.
Yeah.
But
I was afraid you were going to say that. Because I know it's, I don't think it has either. And listen, I'm a white dude. I'm a white guy. I have like people begging me to vote for them. Right? Like I yell at cops and they just say sorry to me. You know what I mean? Like I've noticed it not moving at all. And I, you know, and I consider myself an ally. So I'm in the community and I talk to as many people as I can, but
I think it's interesting because, like you said, just because of, I guess, recent events, there has been, I think in the online like book community, you do see, I guess, like more people being called out more bluntly, which is, I think it's great when we can, And it's rare when we can kind of say this person has done this and, you know, trying to hold them accountable. I know that's happened more recently, but I think once you look at the circumstances that led to that, it's often like directly related to like the Stop Asian Hate campaign, or directly related to like the Black Lives Matter campaign. So it's like somebody dies and then you can say, oh, these people have been racist to me for years. And that's, you know, that's not really okay. We should be able to call out these kinds of harmful behavior all the time. It shouldn't, we shouldn't be emboldened only, or that's when we feel like we're protected. Like nobody can come for us when, you know, we have suffered this tragedy. And I think that's why people speak up at these times and they feel like they can't speak up at other times. So it's really sad.
Yeah. And like, you know, hashtag campaigns and stuff are wonderful, of course. And mm-hmm. you know, how much it affects, you know, actual real changes, I don't know. I would guess very little, but awareness is never a bad thing, I think. I think you probably agree with that too. So I would never discourage people from calling these people out, but, you know, I would also encourage people to look in their own communities and see what they can do, you know, more on the ground. And we all know we'll just maybe keep in the publishing thing for a second. We all know the ways we can support different authors in the publishing community. Libraries are a huge one. Pre-ordering, you know, leaving reviews on Amazon, avoiding Goodreads at all costs, so, the hellscape that it is. I actually had a really great idea about a month ago. I'm going to review Goodreads reviews, but only the ones that are less than 4 stars, right? Just to see where people are at.
You can do the 4.5 star ones. Oh, right.
Right. They're true enough, but yeah. But it's always just like yeah, it's what a weird thing. Anyways, but yeah, no, that's one of those questions where I know the answer, but it's just a sort of like, because you are in Ireland and you have a much different perspective than I do, obviously, in just about every way possible. I wanted to ask because, you know, it's like that small, very tiny part of me hopes to hear one day something has, you know, mood changed for the better. I don't know. We'll see. My God. My biggest fear is that all my favorite, you know, authors are just going to pack up one day and not give us any more stories because we don't fucking deserve them. But anyways, again, talk about irrational. That's me, right? All right, here we go. Everyone likes Humaira Hani Khan. She's easygoing and one of the most popular girls at school. But when she comes out to her friends as bisexual, they invalidate her identity, saying she can't be bi if she's only dated guys. Panicked, Hani blurts out that she's in a relationship with a girl her friends absolutely hate. Ashita Issue Day. Issue is the complete opposite of Hani. She's an academic overachiever who hopes that becoming head girl will set her on the right track for college. But Ashita agrees to help Hani if Hani will help her become more popular, though she stands a chance of being elected head girl. Despite their mutually beneficial pact, they start developing real feelings for each other. But relationships are complicated, and some people will do anything to stop two Bengali girls from achieving happily ever after. That's the promotional language, obviously. It does a pretty good job, actually. Usually I'm down on summaries, but that one's not too bad. But it does sort of leave out, I think, the beating heart of the book. And what's the beating heart of this book?
I don't know. Is that not
is that not it?
Yeah. Question.
Right. Okay. I'll tell you what I think the beating heart of the book is. Yeah. I kind of said it earlier. Affirmation, I think, is an important part, I think, of this story. And it goes to one of the more important parts of this book, which is, so usually in these types of stories, it's built upon a series of moments, right? Like longing stares, quick touch of the hand, you know what I mean, under the table, a series of moments that lead up to a big proclamation of love, let's say, right? But every story sort of has like an aha moment, like a lightning strike. Usually it's internal, when one character, it clicks for one of them, right? When they maybe understand that they are in love. For me, it's early on in the book, actually. It's the name check scene. I don't remember if it's on their first date or just before. It seems trite, but imagine for a second having, you know, your not lifelong-ish best friends never getting your name right, let alone even asking if they're getting it right, and finally, you know, having a peer who sees her for who she is, for the maybe for the first time, And it's a simple thing, right? Just getting her name right and then correcting her name and then saying, no, like, this is your name. Like, they should be calling you by your name. I think that was a really cool moment. I think that was an important moment too. And I think that's the moment Hani said, okay, like, that's, if I'll use a bad thing here, like, she went weak in the knees, I think, at that point. So I think that's, and I think it speaks to the larger thing about this book, about affirmation, because, you know, I just imagine going in, tell me if you've experienced this yourself, going your whole life being, having your name mispronounced, which I'm sure you have, by dumb people like me. You know, I think that's a massively important moment in the book. And I think it kind of speaks to the larger theme of the book. That I, am I completely wrong? If I'm wrong, just tell me, it's fine.
No, you're not wrong. Actually, like, the reason why I guess I kind of decided to write about that is because names are very important in Bengali culture. I mean, they're important in every culture, right? But the whole thing with Bengali nicknames, it's something that is very unique to Bengali culture in a certain way.
What's yours? Do you have one? What do your parents and friends call you?
I do not have a nickname. I was actually Adiba was supposed to be the name that non-family members would call me. And then my middle name was supposed to be the name that my family would call me. But then somebody said something to them that my middle name was like super sacred. And if they didn't pronounce it exactly in the Arabic way, like, it would be like bad. So they got scared.
Really?
Wow. So I don't have a nickname.
Were you even allowed to keep that middle name then or no?
Oh yeah, no, I have that middle name. Just nobody ever calls me that.
Okay.
And honestly, like, it was just dramatic because I have friends who have that name and we call them that. I have cousins who have that name. So it's not, it's not that big a deal. My parents just got scared, I guess.
Sure.
You know, I have some cousins who I literally don't know what their like proper name is.
Right.
Or I only like find out when I get like a wedding invitation. I'm like, whose wedding is this? Like, why am I being invited to it? And then my parents would be like, this is the person's wedding. And I'm just like, okay, wow. I only knew them by their nickname, you know?
Okay.
It's like a very like unique thing to Bengali culture. And so like, for me, I think these things, they can be like a little bit too much for people who are not Bengali, mm-hmm. Or for people who don't really want to get it, if that makes sense. Like sometimes I find I'll explain something about like Bengali culture or Muslim culture and people will just not really try to make the effort to understand that this is a different culture and that there's something different going on with it. But the people who do make an effort to understand and who like ask questions and they want to know like in what way is this culture different from their culture and how can they kind of recognize that and recognize me, I know that they're the people who are, you know, worth me sticking around for. They're the people that I want to be my friends. So for me, like, I guess I wanted to use this very unique Bengali nickname thing to try and explore that and what that kind of means for both Hani and Ishu and how they relate to the world around them.
Mm. It's in a lot of ways, Ishita is me, is us in a lot of ways, because she says great things like, it's only one extra syllable, right? And then, and then the part of her name they do say, they don't even say it right. Like, it's a, you know, it's such a, so she's, you know, expressing sort of like a lot of my inner monologue, you know, when I'm reading this story, the cursing especially. And, you know, it dawns on me, I'm wondering sort of like, who are you more like in real life? I don't know if you are like either one of them, but is there one sort of you lean towards more maybe, or? Are you a combination of both?
I think I am, like, currently I am probably a combination of both. I feel like Ishu is kind of aspirational. Mm-hmm. I would love to be like exactly like her.
Right.
But with Hani, I think when I was a teenager, I was exactly like Hani. Like, so much of her story really came from my experiences. So when I was younger, like, that is who I was. But I think as I've grown older, I'm more of a mix of the two of them.
Mm. I love, you know, it's funny how Ishita's, you know, parent, the non-Muslim side sort of the story, you know, she's more concerned with coming out about her queerness or bisexuality, mm-hmm. even. I think she's queer, right? She's lesbian, I think.
Not lesbian, but she's queer. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You know, you would think it would be the opposite, right? Like, again, from a Western gaze, right? I would think, well, it would make more sense for the, but one of the things I liked about this book was the, you know, the Muslim community you sort of present, the Bengali Muslim community anyways, is pretty welcoming, it feels like to me. Even at the end with, you know, the conservative uncle, who seems like very opening, very mm-hmm. open to new ideas and is much more progressive. And because there's a line somewhere in the book where they refer to him as sort of like he's more conservative, or I can't remember what you said exactly, but and so then immediately I start filling with dread, right? Like, oh no, this is going to cause problems. Hope, you know, because at that point I'm already in. I love Hani and Ishitu, and I don't want anything bad to happen to them, right? But no, they're really welcoming at the end, and even there's a scene near the end which you know expands that even further. Is that, again, what's the experience? Maybe not with you personally, but just what you've seen in the community where, you know, with sort of accepting, you know, the Muslims as queer, whether, and then maybe even like the Bengalis who aren't Muslim, like how's that, what's that been like for you that you've noticed?
Mm-hmm. So I think I know so many Bengali people just from all walks of life and who are just, you know, like very, very diverse.
I want to interrupt just for one quick second because one thing, it just reminded me of something else I really wanted to ask you first, and it leads into it, but because Ishitu's family is, the Day family is rare in a sense that they're a Bengali non-Muslim family, right? Because it is like predominantly Muslim, right?
So actually Ishu is from India, so she's Indian. Okay. Bengali. So actually if you go to West Bengal, which is the part of Bengal in India,
yeah.
It's majority Hindu, and okay. if you go to Bangladesh, it's majority Muslim, though there are actually, like, Hinduism is the second most populous religion in Bangladesh.
Okay so it's not uncommon, is it?
Okay. No, it's not uncommon.
Okay, perfect. All right, sorry, that's why I wanted to, yeah, because it was even within the community, it just it was nice how she wasn't treated like an outsider necessarily,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was nice. Yeah.
Here, you know, I know a lot of non-Muslim, well, not a lot, but I do know like non-Muslim Bengalis, and, you know, they would come hang out with like all the Muslim Bengalis. We have like in Ireland, we have like Hani and Ishu do, we have like Bengali dawats, which are just essentially like dinner parties or lunch parties. And, you know, we always invite all the Bengalis, whether they're Muslim or Hindu or whatever, is just a Bengali thing. So in my experience, and maybe it's a different experience for other people, but in my experience, you know, like religion hasn't really been a thing when somebody's part of your Bengali community.
That's amazing. That's nice to hear. It's actually one of those gatherings that got Hani in trouble with Aisling, wasn't it? She took that picture with Ishitu mm-hmm. back in.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's in the water right now, but I just like, I read like 3 fake dating to lovers books, like in a row, almost, it felt like mm-hmm. there was 3 very close together, and not to dump on the others, but yours was far and away the best for lots of reasons. One of the big ones I think is it's tactility. Like, sure, it's sweet and saccharine at times. Right. But there's a rawness to it emotionally, I think. And, it of course has real world implications. What was it about the sort of that, the fake dating, you know, to lovers thing that appealed to you, but when you were sat down to write, hammer this thing out?
Honestly, like, I just absolutely love the fake dating trope.
So do I.
It's honestly, like, I'm so happy that there are so many fake dating books coming out this year, because, you know, I can read them. I don't know if you saw this, but for Valentine's Day, I did like an entire panel where I invited like a bunch of authors who wrote fake dating also, and we like talked about all things. Which was super fun. So I just love the fake dating trope. I think it's so much fun. I've always wanted to write it. But actually,
what's your least favorite romance trope?
Sorry?
What's your least favorite romance trope?
I don't have one.
I do.
And this is not me like trying to escape an answer, but I just think like all romance tropes can be really well written.
Sure.
It just depends on execution. So
true enough. Yeah. Second chance for me is a non-starter.
Have you read like Jane Austen's Second Chance?
I've read a lot of Second Chance ones, I'm telling you. Even even like Wings of Ebony earlier this year, right? JL's book, like there's
I didn't know that was second chance romance.
There is one in it. It's a triangle. Yeah. And one of them is a second chance. And I was like, nope, he had his shot. He blew it. you get no second chances with me. Sorry. Oh, God. Especially when there's, and then to me, it's crazy. It's just like, why forgive him when there's a clearly great, perfect, you know, person right there. But anyways, that's just me. But you're right. And that doesn't like take me out of the story or doesn't make me hate the book. Or hate the book, like to your point, right? Like it's written so well. Mm-hmm. It's just my personal stupid, you know, isms, right? But
yeah, that's fair.
yeah, because I love Wings of Ebony, but as just far as like, you know, being dorky about it. But it's a really great, I love it as a trope, the fake dating to lovers one, because I just think there's so much room there. And it's important too, because you know, it's these types of books where you know the ending kind of, right? But so it makes it more about the journey. And so it makes the journey that much more important. And, you know, one of the things I think you did with your book that was really great, the journey is great in your book. I love the way you end this book. It feels kind of like epilogue-ish in a way, but it's not, because it's a natural and beautiful extension of the story, and it makes sense to include. I don't know how much we can say about it, but I think we're so used to like this, you know, they kiss happily ever after thing, right? Yeah. You know what I mean? But but with your book, you know, we have this understanding that not all the issues are resolved and some might never be. It's sort of like a happy ending with room to grow, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I'm talking in universe, not the way you executed it, because I thought it was perfectly executed. But, you know, how was writing the ending for this story? Because I love that. I love like this sort of Disney revisionist thing that's happening the last few years, where really great authors are getting a chance to sort of like examine the morning after, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so... Because life isn't perfect, right? It's ugly sometimes, it's messy, and we can't expect, you know, just because there might be a happy ending for this character, you know, we've just spent this whole book learning about all these other characters. So what's going on there? And so how did you, I guess my question is maybe more of a process question, because some people write the ending first. How did you write this story out? Was it linear or?
Yes, I always write linear, because if I don't, like, my brain can't process non-linear things. Okay. Non-linear writing,
right.
But like, actually I'm really glad that you said that about the ending, because I was very nervous when I was writing that.
I've read the ending scene, no bullshit, probably 30 times.
And I think that's more times than I've read it.
I think and I honestly think I might be being modest. I read it again last night before I went to bed, and I read it this morning again. I've read it a lot. I mean, it's not that long, right? The last scene. You know what scene I'm talking about. It's so well done. It's so well written. First of all, I love prologue. This thing that went around a while ago about people who don't read prologues, I think it's insane to me. Like, I'm a cover to cover person. Like, if it's in there, I'll read it. And I love good epilogues and I love good prologues. And this isn't, I got to stay saying epilogue, because this is not an epilogue, but it just feels like it a little bit, because, you know, and you know, I think, you know what I'm trying to say? Like, it does sort of feel like an epilogue in a way, but it's beautiful. And I just love it. But I also love that, yeah, like, and I think even Hani even says at one point, let's not worry about that other stuff right now. Let's just enjoy enjoy the moment. So talk about the ending. Yeah. Like, what would you have, did it change very much from outline to final, or?
No, honestly, like I'm pretty sure my first draft ending is the ending that you have read 30 times, apparently.
I'm not joking. I was talking to Dolly Adler not that long ago too about Cool for Summer, and there's a scene in that book which I've read probably 100 times. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just, it's me. I'm weird. Trust me. You don't ever want to hang out. I'm dumb. But anyways. So yeah. The ending, yeah.
Yeah, this ending, it's the same as it was in the first draft, I think. And I, like I said, I was nervous about it, because yes, it is like, you know, as a romance goes, it is like the happily ever after for the two characters, but there's other things that are maybe not that resolved. And I remember I think I called up one of my friends and I was like, is it okay if I write an ending like this? And she was like, well, as long as like the two main characters get like a happy ending, I think that's a happy ending, right? And I was like, okay, I'm gonna try and write this.
Is that a hard rule? Yeah, so the world could be on fire, but as long as the two, yeah.
It is, because with a romance, you need to give the two main characters like a happy ending. Otherwise it doesn't count as a romance.
True, you're right. Yeah. You're right. It's just like I said, it's sort of a funny, and there's this like, I'm not going to call it a dark cloud, but it is addressed, right? Like I said, Hani Initiative sort of mentioned it really quickly. It has a lot to do has everything to do actually with Ishita's family, which leads me to my next question. Do you have any siblings? Because I wanted to ask you, because the sisters in both of your books are like fucking superheroes, and I love them. Like, you know, Pretty from Henna Wars and Nikita from this book are like, I just would lay down in front of traffic for them. Like they're amazing. So do you have sisters, or you seem to have an affinity for sisters?
I have a sister. My sister is actually, she's a teenager. She's like 10 years younger than me.
Okay.
So I don't think she's really anything like, well, maybe she's a little bit like Prithi. She read the Henna Wars and she was like, my favorite character was Prithi. So
what if I was to ask her this question? Do you think what would she say about you?
I don't know. I think she's a teenager. She's like, she can probably hear me right now. Anyway, she's a teenager. She's like 17. So yeah. I think, I don't know, you know, when you're at a certain teenage age where everything is kind of annoying, I feel like she's at that age. So
Okay. But I'm sure she's happy and proud of you, I would imagine, though, too.
Yes, I think she is. Yes.
Right on. Okay, perfect. Sorry, because a lot of this and talks about sort of what's happening at the end with Ishita's sister, Kit. A lot has to do with her at the ending and sort of unresolved issues there. And it's beautiful. And why I love that scene so much is it just means so much to Kit, right, in that moment. It also speaks to, you know, parents, you know, and approving, disapproving parents, just in general too, right? But especially when you have and I think beyond, you know, Hinduism or Muslim, I think a lot of people can relate to the expectations of parents, whether they're fair or unfair, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Was that anything from you in real life there? How were your parents as far as, you know, just your career choices and stuff like that?
Honestly, like my parents have always been pretty chill. They're not like Ishu and Nick's parents. Mm-hmm. Like for both me and I have an older brother as well. They, you know, they were never, you know, pushing us for career choices, like pushing us one way or another. They were always pretty happy for us to do what we wanted, as long as that was what we wanted and that would make us happy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like a lot of people expect like brown parents to be a certain way, brown and Muslim parents to be like a certain stereotypical way. But that, right. I don't think that was really my experience growing up. You know, my parents have overall been pretty supportive. My mom, like after my copies of the Henna Wars came in, she like borrowed one of them and she's been telling everyone about it. And, same with Honey and Ishu. She was like, when you get your books, like I need to give me one so I can read it. And my mom, like, she can barely read in English. So
pretty cool. That is very cool. She's gonna say like, give me a box of them. I need to hand them out. So but she can read enough English, obviously she can get through it, or does she have to sort of, you know, check with you often on certain phrases?
She can probably read enough to get through, because I don't think like because I see a lot of students who are not students, but a lot of people who for whom English isn't necessarily their first language, and they might struggle a little bit, say that, you know, the Henna Wars is pretty easy to read. So probably for her it's okay.
Right. And so she never read like the outline or anything.
No, because I don't really share that much like with my parents about my writing. Like honestly, my family, they're not big readers in general.
Okay.
Are you
a big reader?
Yes, I have always been a massive reader. And I think for a lot of people in my family, like this was shocking to them because so many of them like they never read books, right? But yeah, I've always been a huge reader.
When you were, so being a huge reader then, did you like, at what point did you just say like, I want to be an author? Like, I want to be a published, working, professional author?
I think there's like different stages because I always knew that I wanted to be a writer.
Is this your
part-time
job now?
Yes, currently,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, perfect.
But yeah, I always wanted to be a writer. I didn't know how possible that was. I guess probably because I didn't see authors who looked like me ever. So I was like, is this like an actual career path for me? Is that possible? So, you know, I studied like English and history, and then I did like my master's, and I was a teacher for a while. And I wasn't sure if this was like a viable career path. And then once I wrote that adult literary fiction, I was like, well, I think this is a good enough story to, you know, try and get published. So let me see like if this is possible, if this is something I can do. And then it just kind of happened. So there was never like a moment where I was like thinking deliberately, like this is going to be my path. I guess I kind of fell into it.
There was no like lightning strike.
When
you said just now, you never thought it was sort of a viable career option. Does that say more about you, or was that just how you were looking at the publishing industry and how they accept people of color and queer writers and Muslim writers?
I think it's difficult to say. But definitely the fact that there were no, you know, people of color, no Muslims, that I was seeing in the publishing industry, I think that did play a huge role because I didn't read a book by a person of color, I think, until I was like 17 or 18.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, Knots and Crosses by Mallory Blackman, mm-hmm. which is, I don't know. I don't think it's like super popular in America and Canada, but it's actually like one of the biggest books I feel of all time here in Ireland and the UK. And that like that book, it was obviously like it's one of my favorite like series of all time. But the fact that Mallory Blackman was kind of the only person doing it, I was like, maybe I could do this, but also like, do I have to write about race in the way that she does? Do I have to be as big as Mallory Blackman? Is that the only way that this is going to happen? So I don't know. It's difficult to say exactly, but these were definitely thoughts that I had when I was younger.
We'll let you get out of here for a couple minutes here. But one of the things that's, you do a really great thing here with sort of with first dates, you know, like quote unquote first dates here. And you sort of put Hani through two first dates, one with, is it Fionn? Fionn?
Fionn.
Fionn. which doesn't go well. And you know, it's, and you don't need to be a brainiac to know that doesn't go well when it ends with this line, like, I'm really interested in hearing about films by pedophile directors. Thank you, by the way, because I agree. I agree. And it fucking baffles my mind that like everyone's just okay with it. not everyone, but most people. Right.
Yeah.
And then we compare that to her first date. It's a fake date, but her first date with Ishu, it's fake, but I mean, we know, right? It's not fake. Where just about everything goes great aside from an awkward sort of run-in at the end of it. Was there any significance there? Like, was that intentional to have those two? Because they're really close together in the book too, those dates, right? So I'm just one, it just felt like they were so close together. There was some intention there to say like, this date was a pile of shit. And, you know, this one was, and again, goes back to sort of like affirmation, you know, issues work and effort into making sure they find the right restaurant and the right menu for Hani. Like, it's so beautiful. Like, I love that. I'm a vegan. So it's like, if someone did that for me, I'd be like, I love you. You know what I mean? So it just felt intentional to me. Was that the case, or are they just timeline, just the way it worked out?
I don't think it was intentional at all. I think it happened by accident. But anyways, I'm glad you know, it felt affirming.
Yeah, it was really great. And I love that line about the pedophile directors. So I wrote that down. I thought that was really funny. And thank you for that, because I totally agree. Hani Ishu's Guide to Fake Dating comes out May 25th. Is there any way, I don't like to support pandemic profiteers myself. Now everyone doesn't have the choice of buying a book wherever they want, but is there anywhere in particular you'd like people to pick this book up? Or any events coming up that you'd like to shout out?
I don't think I have anything coming up. I mean, none of this is announced, but I'm planning like a whole launch week with different content creators. And we're still, you know, trying to organize that. So, you know, if you're around in the virtual space that week of the 25th, there will hopefully be like a bunch of different events going on. Okay. And I would love for people to come to that.
Perfect.
And in terms of where to buy it, unfortunately, not living in, you know, America or Canada, I don't really know a lot of like independent bookshops. So, you know, I just encourage you to support your local bookshops.
Right. Bookshop.org for people in the US is a great resource that literally connects you to independent bookstores all across the country. In Canada, I would recommend Baca Phoenix Books as a really great independent store that ships all across the country. We don't have a bookshop in Canada.org, which is crappy, but we do have
plenty. We don't have one in Ireland either, but there's one in the UK.
That should be everywhere. I don't understand that. But something to do with, I'm sure, international laws or something. But it's a wonderful, wonderful way to get books. And as always, please, you know, pre-order this book. Leave wonderful 5, 10, 11, 12, 20 star reviews. And make sure this book gets into libraries and anywhere else books are rented, sold, loaned, is that the word? I don't know. Whatever the word is. Get it however you can, because like I said, I fell in love with this book and I fell in love with these characters so much. It's the type of characters where like, I want to be friends with them. I want to watch their love grow. I want to watch them, you know, see them accomplish great things. You know what I mean? Like, I would get mad if somebody hurt them in any way. It's like, you really have a great way of you know, making these characters very three-dimensional. And it's really, and all the characters in this book are great. Aside from a one in particular who's not so great, but we won't mention her name. We'll save that. That's a spoiler kind of anyway, so we'll save that. But it top to bottom, great cast. The parents are great too, in a lot of different ways, and they're complicated like the world is, right? And it's not it's not always simple, and they're wonderfully written with a lot of care. That's what I thought anyway. So May 25th, Adiba, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I won't obviously talk to you before then. Have a great Eid. Eat lots of food. have a great ending of the fast. When's that? That's not for a while now. It's still,
I think it's about mid-May, probably around then.
We're still a couple weeks away anyway. So have a wonderful Eid and continued blessings for the rest of the month. And, again, I won't talk to you, so have a wonderful book launch. It's your second book launch, so this is becoming old hat to you, I'm sure. But it is shitty that it's still in a pandemic, though. One thing I love is seeing other authors out in the world, right? Like doing these events. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I love seeing the interaction, you know, between fans when they get to meet their authors. And it's a beautiful experience, I think. And it's one of the many things we've been robbed of the last, you know, year and a half. But hopefully there are brighter days ahead. But Adiba, I can't thank you enough. What time is it there? I don't even, it's 4:30.
4:30, yeah.
Yeah, so please enjoy the rest of your day. It's not too late, sorry. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll talk to you very soon. There you have it, another episode of Everything in Canada all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Adiba for taking the time to speak with me. I'm a huge fan and had such a great time. Like The Hannah Wars, Adiba's sophomore effort is one of those books that, should your mind be open to the idea, will not only entertain you, but help you be a better person through understanding, empathy, and love. Hani and Ishu's Guide to Fake Dating is out now, so head on over to adibajargadhar.com to order a copy today or wherever books are sold. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now. We'll